Good morning, everybody. Happy Wednesday. Happy, I guess, Liberation Day if you're celebrating that. And welcome to the Bitcoin Veteran Spaces, episode 150. I am joined today with a special guest. We have Adrian Morris joining us to talk everything MicroStrategy, everything Bitcoin, and hopefully we can get some insight from him on GameStop. So I just want to go ahead and we'll just start rolling into it. And I want to say good morning, Adrian, and thank you for joining us. I really appreciate that you're able to get on here.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here. Happy that you are willing to have me, and I'm looking forward to a good conversation.
Yeah. So Adrian, if you don't mind, it's been a couple months since we've had you on last time. So if you could just refresh our memory on how you kind of became orange-pilled and what got you into more specifically MicroStrategy.
Sure. So I got into Bitcoin a while ago. The first time I heard about it was, I'd say around 2011, beginning of 20, so end of 2011, beginning of 2012, but I didn't actually get into actually purchasing Bitcoin or even mining Bitcoin until 2013 about fully, even though I bought my first Bitcoin around just before that time. And I guess you can say what orange pilled me is that there are a few guys that I knew in undergrad that were living around me, and just one day randomly I saw them and we just started talking, and he brought up Bitcoin. You know, the first time I heard it, I thought it was a scam because I didn't quite grasp the concept, but he walked me through Bitcoin, not just the technology, but he also walked me through certain aspects of like monetary theory and economics, and he gave me his understanding of what Bitcoin was. So I guess you can say he was the person that got me into the Bitcoin rabbit hole way back when. And it was a very, very random occurrence. And when I first, you know, heard of it, even though I was intrigued once I started understanding it, I still didn't really dive in really. But as I just went deeper and deeper into the rabbit hole, and I started looking at things in, you know, context of like, you know, the subprime mortgage meltdown and other you know, macroeconomic factors, it just started making more and more sense. I've been in ever since. And as far as MicroStrategy, when I first saw that Saylor was doing it, people don't realize that the vast majority of the Bitcoiners were actually skeptical. There were very, very few that were, you know, bullish on the concept. I was one that was skeptical. But that was during 2020 when we had all the stimulus. So I actually bought MicroStrategy back then, but I sold it, before the year, before, first quarter of 2021. So I missed a lot of the run up, and I got back in to MicroStrategy in 2022. But what intrigued me about it is that I just kept seeing Saylor more and more and more. It didn't seem like a gimmick, right? So when I saw that, I said to myself, okay, let me research what a corporation buying Bitcoin would look like. Why would they do it? What would it do to their stock? So on and so forth. And that took me down a whole other rabbit hole, into capital markets, into understanding, the potential for options markets. Just a whole different, way of understanding how Bitcoin can impact a corporation. And how Bitcoin would even live in that kind of a world. And even though I was familiar with options markets and capital markets, it's an entirely different learning curve when you try to weave Bitcoin into that and put Bitcoin on a corporate balance sheet and really understand what the impact can be. So, and then I started meeting up with guys like, you know, with Punter Jeff, Ben Workman, Ryan Reichwant, and others. And we've just been kind of going down this journey together ever since.
Well, that's an amazing story. I like hearing it. I have a question for you though. Like back in 2022, when you started getting back into MicroStrategy, did you foresee that they would be a company that owns 500,000 Bitcoin on their balance sheet? Like, did you foresee them growing this much, or did you think it was going to be muted or limited?
I did not see them getting to 500,000 this quickly. I knew that they were, so I assumed rather that they would stick with it. Because if we look back, 2020, we had all of the, you know, the COVID stimulus, and we had near zero or zero interest rates. So everything was running hot, right? Then we had the blow off top in 21. Then 22, we had FTX. We had FTX collapse. We had Celsius collapsing. We had BlockFi collapsing. We had 3 Hours Capital. We had, you know, Alameda and its relationship to FTX. We had all of those events that blew the market up, right? And at that point, the narrative was Bitcoin has never retraced below its previous all-time high. Well, at that point, the previous all-time high was 20K. We went down to 16 and change, right? I think on some exchanges, we even wicked to 15.9. So seeing that gave me pause. And at that moment, I was actually happy that I wasn't in strategy anymore. However, seeing Saylor still talking about it gave me more and more conviction. Now, at that point, I knew that they were going to stick to it. Did I think they would get to 500,000 Bitcoin by now? No. I saw them getting 100,000, 150,000. I thought that would be pretty impressive. But 500,000 is far more than impressive. And it shows that it doesn't just show conviction. It shows, no pun intended, that they really do have a strategy with this whole thing, right? I think they're being very, very methodical with what they're doing. And now I actually think that they're going to get to 1,000,000 Bitcoin. I think that's the marker that they're probably gunning for. They can likely get to, I would say, between 600,000 and 700,000 by the end of 2025 if they keep going this aggressively. And it really changes the dynamics of what is possible. And we can get into all of that. But no, short answer, I didn't see them getting to 500,000 this quickly. But now in hindsight, looking back on it, am I surprised? Equally no.
Yeah, I'm with you. They really surprised me. I did not get into MicroStrategy as early as you did. I got into it in 23. I was a little skeptical on what he was going to be able to do. But I still think it's very impressive, and his conviction hasn't really changed. So that is a good thing for that. I do just want to let everyone know. Well, first I want to thank everybody who is listening to us this morning. We do have a chat box down in the bottom right-hand corner. So if you'd like to go ahead and ask a question, you're more than welcome to type it in there, and we'll go ahead and relay it to Adrian. If you'd like to come up here on the stage and ask Adrian a question, you're more than welcome to. We just have two rules: no shit coining, and just be kind and courteous to everybody else up here on the panel. So and I do want to acknowledge and say hello to co-host Bob Van Kirk. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning, Coleman. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here, Adrian. Excited to continue the discussion.
Fantastic. Happy to be here with you.
Well, Adrian, I want to go ahead and roll into MicroStrategy's new stock option that they released, the preferred stock with the attached interest rate to it, into perpetuity. Sorry, I can't speak this morning. To be honest with you, I'm not a big fan of it. I think that they were very successful with their convertible bonds. And I don't like that. Now they're going to be on the hook every single year with these interest payments to the shareholders. So can you kind of go over it and just kind of explain in detail what it is?
Well, to understand why they would do it, I think we have to take a few steps back. So there are a few ways that Strategy is looking to purchase Bitcoin, right? So we have the convertible notes, we have the ATM equity offering, we have Strike, and now we have Strife, right? So I don't know how much you've gone into the different levers that Saylor's trying to pull on these spaces. So I'm going to try to give a general overview because I think that gives a lot of context into why they would launch something like Strife. So with convertible notes and debt, right? So businesses are essentially, you know, they're borrowing money from a lender or an investor where both parties are, you know, entering an agreement with the intent to repay all or part of that loan by converting a certain number of it into preferred or common shares at a predetermined point in the future, essentially, right? Which is why you see that a lot of the converts have 28, 29, 30, 31, and 32 as quote unquote due dates, right? So in the case of Strategy, the unique aspect of this is that it creates kind of a feedback loop where they're using, you know, borrowed funds to purchase Bitcoin, which can theoretically both increase the price of Bitcoin and the stock valuation, which will drive up leverage and volatility and simultaneously offer purchasers of the notes downside protection, right? So that's why they're so intriguing to the markets, and that's why they often give strategy 0%. If you think of it, why would a investor, why would a group, why would a fund, why would whoever be so willing to give them hundreds of millions and billions of dollars at 0% unless they were very, very confident on the potential for return? So that is why the convertible debt aspect is so powerful and is so intriguing, and why it's one of the best levers that they can pull, right? And then if we go to the ATM offering, which I think there's a lot of misconception about, you know, so Strategy is essentially selling newly issued shares into the market through designated sales agents at market prices, and that allows them to raise capital while maintaining control over the timing and the size of the sales. And that's what they're called at the market, right? They're somewhat different to other equity issuances. So this is all part of a larger group of issuances that are known as follow-on offerings. A common follow-on offering you hear of is like an IPO, right? Which is an initial public offering of stock shares following a company's company going public, right? So unlike traditional offerings, the ATM offering isn't done at a shelf price, but it's done at a dynamic price, which can keep changing on a regular basis. So what that means is, you know, that allows Strategy to implement price floors below which sales won't occur. They can set percentage limitations on daily sales. They can even start or stop sales based on market conditions. How they do that is via weighted average price algorithms. So they're called a VWAP or a TWAP, right? And I apologize if I'm getting into too much detail, but I think all of this is very, very important. You know, a volume weighted algorithm that helps reduce market impact because, you know, it is essentially aligning trades with an existing market volume. And that provides, you know, less of a volatile price movement, and it kind of allows adjustment for order sizes based on real time volume data, right? So that's a volume weighted average price algorithm, a VWAP. I believe that's the one that Strategy uses 99 times out of 100. A TWAP is a time-weighted average price algorithm. And this helps reduce market impact by consistently spreading the trades evenly over specified time periods and creates predictable trading patterns, right? So through using a VWAP or a TWAP, they're mitigating market impact of share the sales. And they're trying to make them as market neutral as possible, right? So, and this is because the shares are, for lack of a better term, trickling in or rolling into the market through the natural trading flow. And the timing of the sales remains unknown by the market at large. I mean, you can theorize on it by watching price movements and volume activity, but you can't really pinpoint. And this, in theory, prevents preemptive short selling, and the sales can be executed at various times, whether they're at peaks or whether they're bottoms. And these are often done by a third party. Now, coming to the newer offerings, which would be Strike and which would be Strife. So if we talk about Strike first, that is a convertible preferred stock. And we won't get into too many details on Strike versus Strike. Strike versus Strife. I'll just talk about each of them individually. So they had an initial offering of, I believe it was 564 million, I want to say. That was rather upsized. So I think they originally started with 250 and then it went to 564. It was upsized. So, that showed a lot of interest in the market. And essentially what Strike is convertible preferred stock and it pays an 8% dividend yield. So it's a fixed income play, right? And it has the versatility of cash or stock payouts, which optimizes the availability of working capital for Strategy. Now, why Strike is attractive is because it's attracting a different kind of player into the market. You don't get into Strike because you want that upside volatility. You get into Strike because you want the dividend, which is why it's called a fixed income play, right? So it is an entirely different kind of investor that would invest in Strike versus Strategy. However, Strike being another offering, it allows Strategy to now have another way to issue ATM to buy Bitcoin. So if they issue the ATM on Strike, they're using that to buy Bitcoin, which is going to be long-term accretive to the stock, which will be long-term accretive to Strike. It is part of that overall feedback loop that exists in what I like to call the Strategy economy. And I can touch on that concept a little bit later on. So the perpetual structure of these shares, it provides like a bit of a permanent infusion of capital without imposing maturity on the debt. So it somewhat avoids immediate shareholder dilution. And the flexible dividend, you could say that it ensures a way for liquidity to be maintained for future Bitcoin acquisitions because it provides opportunity to refine the company's capital framework. So long story short, Strike is another lever to pull in order to be able to buy Bitcoin. Now, there are a lot of considerations with that, and we can maybe get into those later. But Strife, Perpetual Strife, very interesting name, is another play on in the strategy economy, and it is a perpetual preferred stock offering. They started off, I believe, with 8.5 million shares, $85 each, and it gave them about, I think it was 711 million dollars to play with, and I think their initial target was 500 million. So again, another upsize. Now, the Strife offering, instead of 8%, provide with the option of either converting to shares or cash. The Strife offering doesn't convert to shares, right? So it is a 10% fixed dividend paid in cash quarterly, and I believe that's going to start in June of 25, so June of this year. And as I mentioned, it doesn't offer stock payouts. So this wants to really, really strong arm the liquidity for strategies operations. So on to why you may not like it, or why you may have reservations on it, which are valid, but why I think that this is a good play. With strategy, you have to think of it not as a company issuing stock or a company just issuing different options for the market. You have to think of it as what Saylor has done with strategy is he's created a new economy of scale. And I say that for several reasons. And Strike and Strife and ATM and the convertible notes are all just part of this larger economy. We have the primary stock, MSTR. We also have the options market on MSTR, which between, I think, this week and last, you can have anywhere between, I don't know. Well, let me just say this week and last. Just in general, I've seen anywhere between 60 million to 105 million shares locked up on the options market. The options market's huge. There's more open interest in MicroStrategy than NVIDIA. Okay. Then you have the levered plays on top of MicroStrategy. So you have MSTU and you have MSTX. Those are the two X plays on MicroStrategy. And they also have options market. The options market, the open interest on those options market isn't as large, obviously, but they are levered plays. And in order to provide the returns on those levered plays, they're playing the MicroStrategy options market to do that. That's part of their playbook, right? So we've got MSTR, we've got the MSTR options market, we've got MSTU and MSTX, and we've got their options market. Then we have MSTY, which is a dividend play on MicroStrategy. Now, on top of that, we have OwnB from Bitwise that is going to launch. That is a ETF that has companies wrapped in it that have over 1,000 Bitcoin. So that's OwnB. Now we also are going to have BMAX, which is an ETF that gives exposure to MicroStrategy's convertible notes. Then we have, of course, Bitcoin by itself being part of the strategy economy. And kind of like an auxiliary part because, you know, the strategy has Bitcoin in their balance sheet. And then also because of Bitcoin, you now have IBIT and you have all the options markets in IBIT. So I just laid out between 8 and 10 different wheels and levers that are all interacting in this market. What Saylor is doing is he's creating an economy of scale. And economies of scale, they need different levers. And what he's doing with all these different offerings is creating different levers for different players. You get into Strike if you want a dividend that can then be converted into shares at a 10-to-1 ratio. You get into Strife if you want more of a bond-like play, because it's a perpetual preferred stock offering that allows you to get that 10%. You get into MSTR because you want that additional volatility on top of Bitcoin. You get into MSTR options if you want added volatility on top of that. You get into MSTU or MSTX if you want even more volatility on top of that and the options market. You get into MSTY if you want another dividend play. That's what he's doing. So don't think of it in terms of, oh, they're just issuing another offering, and now they're on the hook for those payouts because there's many ways they can pay those out, right? If you take a look at the math behind it, the average ATM that they do is exponentially larger than the amount they will need for the payouts. So there are no real danger of, if you think of it, of, you know, for lack of a better term, blowing up. They're just creating different feedback loops within this economy that will allow it to scale and grow over time. And I'm sorry, that was a very, very long spiel there, but those are my general thoughts.
No, it was well detailed. I do appreciate that, Adrian. So I guess that was my biggest concern, which you just addressed, is that there's always going to be an option for them to have a way to pay off those dividends. Because just my back of the paper math, it was about $70 million is what they have to pay out every year for that, correct?
I haven't done the math on it recently, but that sounds about right.
Okay. And so I guess my concern was if Bitcoin, you know, doesn't do anything, it just, if it goes down to nothing, let's just say that happens, then their tech company only makes about 100, 150 million a year, right? So then it looks like they're just gonna be in a lot of trouble. That was my thought on it anyways. I'm still not entirely sold on it. I think he just had a good play with the bonds and the other options. So that's kind of where I sit.
Well, yeah. So, and the thing is, you're actually illustrating the very, very point of it. This isn't the play for you as a player in this strategy economy, as a player in the strategy market, right? This doesn't appeal to you because you have your concerns. However, if we take a look at the offerings and the fact that they were upsized, it clearly does appeal to many players in the market. And that is the point there. He wants to attract as many players to this economy for as many different reasons as possible. And to do that, he needs many, many different offerings. It cannot just be MSTR, ATM, and convertible notes, right? He's got to really entice the market and different market players to participate in the market with different kinds of offerings. So while this may not be one that is attractive for you and that may give you pause, for many other players in the market, they don't have that kind of reservation for whatever reasons. And we don't even need to speculate on that. So simultaneously, your concern is valid, but also your concern is there a very, very reason why he would create this offering. Because for someone that is, for instance, playing with tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, would they necessarily need all the volatility? Maybe, maybe not. Or would they be more interested in more of a fixed income play that's going to give them 8% in the case of Strife with the option to convert, or 10% in the case of Strife without the option to convert, right? So so you have a fixed income preferred stock, you have more of a fixed income perpetual preferred that's going to option more like a bond. And then we have all the other options in the market. Sorry, not options. Well, yes, options, but I didn't mean the options market. You have all these other offerings in the market that many, many players can come to the market and play with. And that's why I say it's an economy. And it is a fundamentally different concept because with Bitcoin, what he's doing is that he's putting Bitcoin smack dab in the middle of traditional finance now. And as this thing grows, because believe me, Bitcoin does what we think it's going to do. Strategy is going to be a $1 trillion company, right? It's going to be on max 7 footing at that point. What happens when you have a company in the center of this new economy that can then now go to the market and say, we want to leverage a percentage of our stack to generate yield? If Bitcoin is at, I don't know, 250,000, let's say they put 10, 20, 30, 40,000 Bitcoin into a yield generating play of some kind, then you have to look at strategy more in terms of PE ratios and what they can do, right? And then there's always the play that everyone talks about that they want to become a Bitcoin bank. That's another lever that's going to be added to the market. He's only going to add more and more levers to this play. And that is why it's going to become an economy. Bitcoin goes to zero. I mean, we're all screwed. A lot of us, right? But that's likely not going to happen at this point. Bitcoin, everyone that tries to call it a bubble, what they fail to realize is that bubbles don't inflate, deflate, then reflate bigger last time. They pop. That's what a bubble is. Going from, you know, 10 million market cap to 5 million to 50 million to 20 million to 100 million to 70 million to 500 million to 250 million to billions and billions and billions, then to a trillion, to under a trillion, then to over 2 trillion, that's not a bubble. That is a new paradigm shift occurring. And that is, again, a secondary economy being built up in markets. Bitcoin is going to be that secondary rail that everyone is going to want to play on. And that is what Strategy is doing.
Oh, I like that. Well, thank you for that, Adrian. I do want to go and kind of squash something else that we hit on earlier. And it's with the ATM and mm-hmm. why shared dilution for MicroStrategy is not like a shared dilution for any other company, simply because when they do it, they're adding more Bitcoin to each individual share. Can you kind of explain that for someone who might be confused?
Yeah. So, this is actually something I'm rather, passionate about when it comes to topics on Strategy, just because I think that there are, there's a lot of misinformation with it. So let's go back to what I said about the ATM. First, I think people really do have this notion that Saylor and his minions are executing these trades themselves, right? That's not what's going on. As I mentioned, this is actually executed by third party. And this is executed algorithmically by either a VWAP or a TWAP, volume-weighted average price algorithm or time-weighted average price algorithm. So with that said, we have to take into account all of the aspects that go into an ATM again, right? It's not just a matter of the shares being sold to buy Bitcoin, which is accretive dilution, as the term is, right? And why is it accretive dilution? Because, yes, we are, quote-unquote, diluting the shares. However, those shares are being used to buy Bitcoin, which is going to be added to the company balance sheet, which is going to drive up the price of the stock, is going to drive up interest in the stock in the open market, is going to increase volatility passively, so on and so on and so forth. Convertible debt increases the volatility more directly. The ATM increases the volatility of the stock more passively. So with that said, you in the Q4 presentation, Saylor was walking through a slide where he showed that the ATM was something like 2.9 to 3% of cumulative trading volume. What that means is that of all the open volume on the market when they were issuing the ATM, the total amount of shares sold versus the actual total volume of shares being exchanged in the market was only 3%. Now, people come back and say, well, that 3% is significant because if you take into account the fact that the options market, when shares in the options market, those are locked up, they're not actively being exchanged, and a lot of the volatility happens at the margins, which means that wild price swings can happen up or down at the margins, which is saying that it takes a very, very little amount of impact to create a outsized reaction. This is a very, very simplistic way of looking at it. So, you have the accretive dilution, which is shares being sold to buy Bitcoin, that is going to drive up interest in the stock, that's going to drive up the value of the stock, which is going to increase value to shareholders, right? So that's the first aspect. The second aspect is that the ATM itself is suppressing the stock price. Now, you have 3%, which can theoretically push the price down, and many people harp on it and say, well, it's happening at the margins, and that 3% is significant to one of the most volatile, highly traded, highly exchanged stocks in the world. To which I say, yes, that is possible. But then my immediate question to them is, okay, so what about the other 97%? You haven't accounted for the other 97% of trading activity in your thesis. You're just saying that this 3% is pushing the price down. That is a very, very reductive emotional reaction, for lack of a better term. So the ATM has wide misconceptions around it. It is not diluting shareholders in a traditional sense. The ATM is being issued at the market. Those shares are being used to buy Bitcoin. The Bitcoin is going on the balance sheet, which is going to drive up the share price. People only complain about the ATM when we have lulls in the market or we have downturns in the market. When Saylor is still doing the ATM, they're saying, see, the price is going down. It's because they're still issuing the ATM. Not taking into account, if we look again at this economy of scale example, where I went through, we have MSTOI, we have MSTU, we have MSTX, we have MSTR, we now will have additional players into market. On top of that, we also have the options market. We have the fact that MicroStrategy has almost a 70% correlation to Bitcoin price movements at times, which means that the price is highly, highly influenced by what Bitcoin is doing as well, which means it's at the mercy of spot share, the spot market, the futures market, and all the manipulation that goes on there, IBIT, and all the options plays that can go on in IBIT. I can go on and on and on. There's a lot of misconception around ATM. So the TLDR is one, it's a creative dilution. It is not traditional dilution. It is not intended to quote unquote screw the shareholders. And two, the ATM sales are not responsible for stock price downturns. That is a very simplistic and reductivist stance.
So then the reason that the stock price, you could say, has been muted over the last 4 or 5 months is just because of all the options that are on the table then? Because MSTR had a high of about 470 near the third quarter of November, and Bitcoin price is around 94, 95K. Now we're sitting about 84, 85K with Bitcoin price, and MSTR is sitting around $300.
Well, I think the high was more like 543, the total high. And again, I can speculate with you right now a dozen different ways as to why the stock is doing what it's doing. But the best way to look at it is that just because Bitcoin is at 80K, And MSTR was at 475 or have you. And now Bitcoin or when Bitcoin was at 100K and MSTR was at under, what's that, sub 400. And now Bitcoin is at 84K or 83K or whatever it is. And MSTR is hovering around 300. You can't then say that, oh, well, it must be the options market, or it could be the ATM, or it can be this, or it could be that. At any given time, there are several, there's dozens of things that are playing in what is happening with the MSTR stock price. It is not muted because of one thing or another. There are several market dynamics that come into play. There's also the fact that overall liquidity started to dry up in Q3 and Q4, right when Strategy stock reached its peak. And then had that rapid sell-off. There's just too many things that go into play when it comes to the stock price to speculate on why one or another is doing anything. So I don't want that could be either wrong or misguided. I would just say that when you're looking at strategy, you cannot just think of it in terms of one play or one aspect that is driving stock price. You have to say, am I looking at open interest? Am I looking at what's going on with the levered plays? Am I looking at what's going on with overall global liquidity? Am I looking at what's going on with overall Bitcoin price? You need to look at so many different things in order to get a beat on this. And that is why it's so hard for the market to price it. And that's part of the confusion that happens. Well, why is it the price dropping when Bitcoin is doing this? Well, now Bitcoin is lower. Why is the price rising? There's too many things at play, and I really wish I can give you an answer that's going to be definitive, but I just can't.
When do you think the market figures it out and prices strategy accordingly? Because since November, they've added about, it's got to be close to 200,000 Bitcoin. I don't have the exact numbers on, so I do apologize. But for a while there, they were trading at like a 4X, right?
Are you referring to MNAV?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, it was trading at 4X, and I'm one of the people that thinks MNAV is garbage. So, but yes, they were trading at close to 4X or above 4X at one point, actually.
So then I'm not going to hold you to it, but if you don't mind sharing, when do you think that the market really starts to understand that this is going to be a $1 trillion company and there's going to be a mad scramble for this product?
Well, let's use an interesting parallel here. Look at NVIDIA. For many, many, I'm also an NVIDIA shareholder, full disclosure. For many, many years, what I heard is that NVIDIA wouldn't be able to scale. I heard NVIDIA, they only have a niche in gaming. They're not going to be able to become a really big company. What if another company develops more efficient systems? There's all kinds of narratives as to why NVIDIA would fail, right? But Jensen Huang was saying this entire time, gaming isn't our end game. Gaming is just one part of the puzzle. The GPUs, we have the ability to use them for various other things. And then ChatGPT happened, and the rest is history, right? I think that moment for strategy happens when a few factors coalesce. One, I think it's going to take till next cycle, so the next Bitcoin cycle, 2028 at the earliest. That's my personal thesis. And I say that because we need to have a maturity in Bitcoin within traditional finance. Strategy represents a preemptive entry of Bitcoin into traditional finance. The maturity for Bitcoin into traditional finance, whether people want to accept it or not, is going to come through the ETFs. And typically, ETFs see increasing inflows within the first 5 years, I believe the figure is. So year over year over year, they're going to see increasing inflows. And when you take outflows into account, so when you have that net at the end, that's where you get that increasing, those increasing inflows from. What that means to me is TradFi becomes more and more comfortable with Bitcoin. The ETFs grow in size. You likely are going to have more and more offerings. And then you have the oh shit moment for Strategy. And I think the oh shit moment is when they really start to leverage the Bitcoin on their balance sheet. Right now, they're not leveraging the Bitcoin on their balance sheet. They are accumulating Bitcoin and using it as a hedge against inflation, using it as a hedge against all kinds of different market factors. They're also using it to increase the volatility of the stock, which is also increasing interest in the stock, which is also increasing the price of the stock. The oh shit moment comes when they have something like 600,000, 700,000, 800,000 or 1 million Bitcoin, and they can now truly go to market and say, okay, guys, it's been fun, but now we really want to disrupt. Now we are effectively a Bitcoin bank. Or now we can go to market and generate yield on our holdings. If you want to have some fun, just take, I don't know, 200,000 Bitcoin at a price of 250,000 and say, what's 5%? You just imagine that coming into the company now on top of their software business, which can scale, by the way. I am not one of those people that thinks that the software business cannot scale. It absolutely can and it will scale for various reasons. That is when I think the market will start pricing it effectively. When that oh shit moment happens and they realize, oh, this isn't just some kind of a leveraged Bitcoin play. They really are the center of a new economy. They really are a Bitcoin, or they really can become a Bitcoin bank. They can generate yield on top of their Bitcoin. They can go to market with all kinds of different offerings now because they can generate yield on top of their Bitcoin. When that moment happens, and I think it's going to happen between now and the next cycle, that's when the fun really starts. What we're seeing right now in this cycle is going to be great. I'm not one of those ones that thinks they can hit $4,000 a share or anything like that this cycle. That's not me. I'm far more measured. I mean, I have fun with Josh Mandel and his posts, and we talk. But I don't think we're going to hit 444,000. I don't think we're going to hit 1,000 to 4,000 share for MicroStrategy. Not this cycle. I think next cycle is when the fun really starts.
Well, thank you for that. I'm going to throw it over to Bitcoin for Presidents. You have a question, sir?
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my question. It's for Adrian.
I had two questions, but one was, what do you think, the first one, what do you think would be better to hold over a 4 to 8 year period? Just regular old Bitcoin on your hard, you know, cold wallet or your, you know, on your phone or whatever, or would you rather have it in MSTR? Because I have my daughter in both of them and I scaled her out when it was, you know, going to like 500. I got out of like 357, unfortunately, some of her shares, but I still hold quite a bit of her custodial account in MSTR and I waffle on just going to Bitcoin.
Well, the Bitcoiner in me will say more Bitcoin than MicroStrategy. That's just my personal feeling. However, if I'm giving you a more fleshed out and nuanced answer, that would depend entirely on what your appetite is. Are you a person that can play the options market? If you are,
yes.
If you are, then I would say it makes, if you have, I don't know. I'm just throwing out a figure here. I'm not saying this is what you have or don't have. If you have $100,000, it wouldn't hurt for you to have 30,000 in cold storage, 30,000 in IBIT, 30,000 in Strategy. And with IBIT and Strategy, see how you can play the options market and see how you can accumulate more. If you're comfortable with leverage, you're comfortable with margin, that becomes very, very interesting. If you are a person that just wants to hold an asset that's going to mature over time, I would say, you know, 60-40 wouldn't hurt. 60 Bitcoin cold storage, 40 in strategy. Or you can even then say, if you want to use the example from before, you can have, let's say, 35% in cold storage, 35% in IBIT, 30% in strategy. This, of course, is not financial advice. I'm just saying that I don't think that it's as simple as saying what one is better than the other. If you take it in terms of, well, strategy is going to be, is a leveraged play, and so it's going to outperform 1 to 2 to 3 to 4x, then hold out the whole strategy if you want. Just realize that you can't time the market. And if you think that you're going to catch it when it runs up to $2,000 and sell the Pico top, I will tell you that is likely not to happen. You're going to see far more volatility, peaks and troughs with strategy than you will with Bitcoin. So you have to take all those things into account.
Right on. That, that makes sense. A little diversification in that. Well, the other question was, where do you see, MSTR and Bitcoin in 25 years? Cause I'm about almost 50. When I'm 75, do you have a long-term outlook? I don't know your age, but, you seem to know a lot about, a lot more than I do, so I was just looking for your opinion on a 25-year like timeline, because Bitcoin makes you think in long term.
Right. So, let me come back to the previous point really quickly. That is what I'm what I'm suggesting is not diversification, because if you think about it, everything is a Bitcoin play. You have direct Bitcoin in cold storage, you have exposure to Bitcoin in IBIT, you have levered Bitcoin in MicroStrategy, right? So that is not diversification. Let me give it a 30 second spiel on that. The only diversification I have right now is Bitcoin, leveraged Bitcoin, robotics, and AI. You stay in those four for the next 25 years, you're probably going to be fine. Now, to your more direct point, where do I see Bitcoin and strategy in the next 25 years? I think that is a more nuanced answer for several reasons. Firstly, Bitcoin in 2025 right now, so we're talking 2050. In 2050, is it possible that Bitcoin is several million dollars a coin? Certainly. It absolutely is. I think the more likely outcome we're going to see is run-ups and then not run-offs, but like stabilization. So I think that we have several psychological levels to clear. Once Bitcoin hits 200, so 100,000 was a major psychological level, right? Now that's been hit, everyone's over it. They're like, okay, where's 150? 250,000 is going to be another major psychological level. Once we hit that, I would expect a sell-off. I would expect that, and I don't think a sell-off down to 80K or anything like that. I think having the institutions, the ETFs, in the market right now makes that less likely. They're ironically, in my view, going to help stabilize the price of Bitcoin. So we're going to see 250,000, then we're going to see a leveling off. I think it's going to take longer than people realize to go from 250 to 1 million, because you need a lot of liquidity to do that. A lot of liquidity. 50,000 Bitcoin is a $1 trillion market cap. 100,000 Bitcoin is essentially a $2 trillion market cap. We're now talking about a $20 trillion market cap at $1 million. That is going to be far more difficult than people realize to hit. And that's going to take longer than I think people realize to hit. Because at $20 trillion, that is now a preeminent player in the global marketplace. It is no longer a fad. It is no longer new. It is no longer, oh, we're so early. At $20 trillion, we are here. And then it becomes a matter of, well, how many people are here with us? So that's a million. 5 million, you're now at 100 trillion. 10 million, you're now at 200 trillion. So if you understand where I'm going with this, what I'm saying is the larger Bitcoin becomes, the more significant in the global marketplace it becomes. And then the moves are going to be harder and harder, because it's going to take a lot more liquidity to move the price the higher it goes. So while Saylor thinks it can hit 13 million, I'm more along the lines of, let's see what happens at 1 to 3. Now, at $1 to $3 million, if strategy has 1 million Bitcoin, if you take premium, like the premium to NAV, which I think is garbage, but whatever, if you take that kind of a, look at it, if you also have them leveraging Bitcoin, to generate yields, if you also have all these levered plays in the market, which are only going to grow, if you have all these different offerings, which are only going to scale, when you have strategies sucking in money from the global bond market, when you have all of those things, if we didn't have a stock split again, which we're going to in all likelihood, obviously, and they have more and more shares that they can issue to the market, you're looking at several $1,000 a share, right? And that's assume, and when I say several thousand, I'm talking, you know, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a share, but they're going to issue a stock split before that. So take whatever you have right now, multiply it by 10 or maybe even 100, and then you can, you're looking at anything between, I don't know, a $500 share or a $50 share. But you'll have $50 share at, if you hold, that is, if you have 1,000 shares right now, you'll have 100,000 shares at $50. There's all kinds of different ways this thing can play out. I think that, long story short, number go up. And I think it's going to be very, very, very beneficial to hold it long term.
Thanks for that explanation. Yeah, thank you very much. So Adrian, the undoubtedly MicroStrategy, Michael Saylor front running Bitcoin. I tend to agree with you that this is going to take some time, but I think it's pretty easy to see how he's kind of creating these financial products probably ahead of most of the demand. One thing I wonder about your calculations is other entities that may be employing the same strategy as Strategy or MicroStrategy. And so maybe this is a good place to shift towards GameStop a little bit and just what your thoughts are around them and then maybe some others that we can't see yet that are coming into the market. So could you kind of tap on that and address that a little bit?
Well, yes, it's a simple adage that you don't want to go where the puck is. You want to go where the puck's going to be, right? So he absolutely is front running the market. And what you're seeing with these offerings right now is that front running. And that's why I say he's creating an economy. What Saylor is doing is he wants that by the time the, you know, as I refer to it as the oh shit moment happens, he's already positioned. Okay. And if you look at some of the things that he says, he's already said, you know, let them waffle and try to figure it out. By the time they do, you'll be at 10 million a coin or something like that, right? He's definitely front running. He wants to be in position and he wants to be positioned when that trend, that real oh shit moment happens. Now, when you look at GME, for instance, one of the common criticisms I've heard people say is, well, they have like $4 billion on the balance sheet. Why didn't they just use the $4 billion to buy all Bitcoin? That doesn't really make sense. If you think of it in terms of, are they following the Saylor playbook, which I think they are, by the fact that they issued 1.3 in convertible debt with a green shoe option of 200 million. And it looks like they're going to execute that 200 million. So they have about 1.48 billion to play with to quote unquote cover corporate expenses and costs and buy Bitcoin in a manner that's consistent with the corporate strategy, blah, 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 blah. I think what they're doing is following the Saylor playbook. And the reason why they issued convertible debt instead of paying with cash is one, why buy when you can finance it at 0%? And two, coming back to the strategy example, the convertible notes are a way to ramp up the volatility on the balance sheet, right? So the volatility of the stock will go up. Open interest and options likely will go up as well. Those premiums will go up as well. The interest in the stock will go up as well. And then that whole feedback loop that we discussed earlier comes into play. I can see them at some point doing ATM offerings as well. I don't see why they would not. And just generating that kind of volatility and interest in the stock the same way that Strategy did. The reason why I am cautiously bullish on GameStop is because they are at a fundamentally different point starting this play than Strategy was, right? Strategy was nowhere near where GameStop was when they started this play. Now, do I think GameStop's going to get to 500,000 and a million Bitcoin? No. I think Saylor has a head start right now that in years hence, people are going to look back and say, God damn it, he really did front run the hell out of this thing. So I think GameStop is going to be a potentially interesting play, not financial advice to anyone listening. I would suggest that you do your own due diligence there. You have the other players in the market, the Semler Scientifics, the Cooler, you have Rumble, you have, you know, all these other players in the market. And people also forget that another player that still has Bitcoin, that is benefiting from Bitcoin on their balance sheet, as you know, kind of highlighted in their last earnings call, was Tesla. They are a Mag 7 company that has Bitcoin on the balance sheet, and it's not impossible at some point in the future for them to buy more. There's going to be a lot that goes into this new Bitcoin economy and this new strategy economy, and I think that we're in for a very, very interesting ride.
Yeah, that's for sure. Hey, we're getting towards the top of the hour. I want to be respectful of your time, but also want to give a shout out to our sponsors real quick. We have Black Sheep Ammo. Restock your ammo at blacksheepammo.com. Solo Satoshi, open source Bitcoin mining at solosatoshi.com. If you go to their site, please use our code BTCVETS for 5% off. And if you use Bitcoin, you can get another 10% off. Stamp your seed phrase on a metal plate. Visit punchplate.com. That's punchplate.com. We also have Paladin Tower Tactics, professional firearms and tactical training at paladintowertactics.com. And lastly, Fountain FM. Listen to your favorite podcast or music and support your favorite artist or podcaster with sats. You can zap sats at Fountain.fm and listen to your favorite podcast or music. With that, I think we have Wade up here. Wade, did you have questions? And then also maybe before that, Adrian, you have a few more minutes to hang out with us?
I can go for 5 minutes after. Then I have a pretty hard stop.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Wade, did you have a question for Adrian?
Yeah, just a quick question. Hey, Adrian, considering where price action has been, there's been a lot of whining lately since the recent corrections starting in, you know, late November, early December and whatnot in regards to both MicroStrategy and the Bitcoin price. But overall, the market looks pretty resilient considering the macro environment. And I was just wondering what your guys' thoughts and the MST, the MicroStrategy True North consensus might be regarding the Scott Bessent's treasury issuance strategy and the impact of tariffs on the macro environment.
So I can't speak for everyone in the group. I can only speak for myself. I don't really have an opinion yet on the treasury issuance strategy. However, on tariffs, I can come to that. But firstly, to your first part of the question. So if we take a look at, and I know it's very, very in vogue right now to poo-poo M2 and liquidity, just because it's a popular talking point right now, but I think people need to have a broader perspective and look at things from multiple angles. There was a clear peak in liquidity, Q4 2024, Q3 2024, right? And then liquidity started to dry up. I don't think it's entirely surprising that the price of Bitcoin and thus the price of Strategy tapered off as well. I thought we would have the likelihood of that liquidity staying in a little bit because, you know, with Trump's election and him being pro-Bitcoin, I thought that, that, you know, for lack of a better term, Trump pump would last much longer. However, we see that his, you know, his views on tariffs and how he's leveraging them have definitely cooled some of that off near term. So, I think what's going on right now is that the market is trying to react to and understand what is going to happen with the tariffs. But to your point, the market has been very, very resilient. Considering that in many ways it's the Mag 7 that's holding up the market, they've taken a beating, but they're so large that losing $1.5 trillion in their market cap didn't kill them, right, collectively. So the resilience is there. I think that the resilience in Bitcoin has been especially encouraging. Because previous cycles, all of this news would have caused a nuke down to 60, right? The drop off would have been far more violent than going from 109 to, like, I think we filled the gap at 77. That, in my view, one, is a normal bull cycle correction or a market correction. And two, it is indicative of Bitcoin's resilience, right? Given the doom and gloom and sentiments in the market, you would assume that we should have completely shat the bed by now, but we haven't. We've just seen normal volatility in Bitcoin. Now, coming back to the tariffs a little bit more, and again, this is not anything political. This is not an endorsement of Trump. This is not a indictment of Biden. This is not anything like that, or an endorsement of Biden or an indictment of Trump. This is just straight up facts. The impact of tariffs, I think there's a bit of a misguided narrative around it that it's going to somehow impact inflation because prices are going to go up. In reality, what we're seeing or what we will see in terms of price increase isn't because of inflation. It's because of essentially a consumption tax. You have a US-based product that's going to be a dollar. Then you have an imported product that will be $1.25. And that is your choice in whether you want to pay the $1.25 for the imported product for whatever reason, or if you want to pay a dollar for the US version. That's what it's going to break down to, is a consumption tax. And that consumption tax goes directly to the government. And people can say, well, then it's passed on as a consumer. But again, taking politics and personal opinion out of it, we do live in a capitalistic society, and the whole notion is supposed to be you have choice, right, with what you want to spend your capital on. Do you want to spend the money on the consumption tax or not? Do you want to buy that BMW or can you live with the Cadillac? Do you want that Mercedes or can you live with the Ford? It's all up to you, really, at the end of it. And I think that's what the market's trying to figure out right now. However, we are seeing that because of this, we may theoretically see a return to U.S. manufacturing and so on and so forth. I think that's going to take much longer to play out. I don't think that's going to be a quarter-to-quarter thing. I think it's going to be a year-over-year thing. I'm currently in Arizona, and TSMC is talking about investing in tens of billions to $100 billion in the plant that's here. That has created a significant effect locally that's not being reported on, because this TSMC plant and other plants like it in the U.S. prevents the impact of what I like to call a red scare, right? So what I mean by that is that China invades Taiwan and all hell breaks loose in terms of the global semiconductor market. If we have some more domestic production, we can soften the blow on that. And I think, you know, if you want another projection there, I think that's one long-term risk to NVIDIA, is if China does invade Taiwan and what happens there. But if we have, again, more domestic production, that impact can be lessened, and the impact on the global market can be lessened. I hope that answered your question, because I went off on a bit of a tangent there with some things.
Adrian, just a follow-up on that. Can I, Wade? Do you think that this afternoon's press conference is going to, I guess, just your personal opinion, do you think Trump's going to be pedal to the metal and say, this is, you know, permanent, this is something this is part of the overall plan? Or do you think it'll be nuanced and he'll back off a little bit?
If you want me to be completely honest, I'm not sure. I think his long-term play is that he's playing a game of chicken with the Fed. I think that's one of the long-term plays. I think what he wants to do is potentially, I don't know how serious he is about eliminating the IRS. Quite frankly, this is just me being fully transparent. The IRS is one of the most insidiously bureaucratic industry offices that we have in this nation. I firmly believe that Christ could descend from the heavens and say that it should be stopped, and they still won't stop it. The IRS, Uncle Sam wants his cut, and he's going to get it one way or another. And the IRS is woven into everything with that. Now, can tariffs offset that? Yes, because we didn't have income tax until 1913. So we can go back to tariffs. I just think it's going to be a very disruptive transition. That's part one of what I think Trump is trying to do. He's trying to see if it's even possible, and he's willing to shake the tree to see how far he can get on that. Part two, playing a game of chicken with the Fed. He wants rates lowered. And the way that we can do that is by creating market turmoil and, you know, softening up the economy, maybe inducing a soft recession. And then the Fed has the impetus to say, okay, we can cut now. Here's this problem with all that. That's all theater. We have debt that has to be serviced. The interest rate is too high. We cannot service the debt. The rates have to come down one way or another. Now, they're not going to come. I don't think they're going to come down in April. I don't think they're maybe May or maybe sometime in the summer. Can we see a little bit of a cut? I think that's very, very possible. The third part of the puzzle is, I think, and again, this is just my personal opinion, that he wants to be credited with creating a booming economy, and he's going to do that one way or another. If he needs to create complete chaos to do it, he'll do it. If he needs to shake the tree, he'll do it. If he needs to saber rattle on tariffs and get ridiculous with them, I think he will do it. And I think in his mind, because he's thinking about this in terms more of business, he believes that the short-term pain for long-term gain is worth it. However, I think his blind spot, or maybe he just doesn't care, is that that is creating a lot of chaos for the average American citizen. So today, I can't really put my finger on what he will say, but that is just my overall view of what he's doing.
Does that lend credence to the... Just real quick, Andrew, does that lend credence to the Luke Grohman argument that a sustained downturn cannot be tolerated basically by the defense sector and by DC? That the national security of the United States is dependent upon the growth of these tax receipts, the growth of these market, and a sustained bear market is simply not tolerable from a national security standpoint.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's validity to that. So here's the thing, and this is something that Ralph Hall and others have talked about as well. In 2008, the system broke. And I think it broke in an irreparable sense. What I mean by that is, if we were to see a 2008 level or worse event again, because for instance, you saw what happened to the COVID crash, right? That led to wild printing and a wild run in the markets, right? Also, people forget that what happened after 2008, we essentially have been in a secular bull run for 25 years at this point. Because even if you take into account the drop-off from the COVID crash, you take into account the drop-off from the GFC, we're still in a secular bull market because printing never stopped. It just happened for different reasons. So with that said, I don't think at this point they can have that happen because I hate using this term, things have become too big to fail. And I know people said that before, and they just got bigger and bigger, but let me just give this little spiel here. What, at this point, would happen if we see a true, sustained, brutal recession is outright chaos in the markets, is what my view is. And I say that because since 2008, a lot of the economic growth we've seen has been fugazi. Think about the number, and this is not a knock on it. This is just me talking about it in plain terms. If you look at the gig economy, we have Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Uber Eats, Instacart, so on and so forth. We have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans that are doing that as a full-time job. No benefits, no real long-term career growth. They're just doing it because it is a way for them to survive. They're doing it sometimes as a second or third job as well, right? So that's why you see a lot of the concentrated growth in the Mag 7 and that they've exploded. Why have they exploded? Because I think the big boys know the jig is up and we're about to see a transition to an AI and robotics dominated economy. And that's the other kind of front running that's going on right now. Saylor's front running Bitcoin. The Mag 7 is front running robotics and AI. And we're going to have a bifurcated economy where it's going to be robotics, AI, and everything else. Now, with that said, the government, the market, the military industrial complex, so on and so forth, at this point, they cannot tolerate a persistent downturn because they've already put up too much capital up front. All of this growth we've seen is them taking a bet on the future, in my view, and they're not going to lose that bet. So whatever needs to happen, whether it needs to be in the form of rate cuts, stimulus, the list goes on and on and on. The debt still needs to be serviced. All of this is theater. The printer is going to turn on at some point. They're just trying to figure out what way and what excuse they can give them the impetus to do it. And this is not me saying, oh guys, everything's going to be fine. Go balls deep in the market, leverage your house and invest in everything. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying, however, is be aware that and be prepared that in the next 5 to 10 years, if you think the ChatGPT moment that happened and then all of a sudden AIs and everything was surprising, just wait until they have Amazon and those other companies now have the ability to replace their entire workforce with robots. What happens to their stock price then? Watch what happens to Tesla's stock price. Watch what happens to companies like Figure when they eventually go public. That's going to be the moment, another oh shit moment, where people get caught with their pants down. So I'm saying all of this to say that ignore the noise. If you can weather the storm, keep your eye on the ball and keep the main thing the main thing. I'm assuming that many people are on this space and are in this market because they're trying to give themselves a leg up on the future, or rather a leg up in the future, because the game is rigged and we're trying to find ways to win within that rigged game. Just keep your eye on the ball if you can. Here's my last piece of that puzzle that I can give.
Yeah, thank you, Adrian. This has been an excellent conversation. Hope to have you back. For those listeners,
I'd be happy to.
Awesome. Yeah. For those listeners that are new to our space, we host these every weekday, 10 a.m. Eastern. And so we'd love to have you guys join us in the future. Adrian, did you have any final words before we close it up?
Just that I'm very grateful that you had me on. I was happy to have this conversation with you guys. I think you asked some very, very good questions. We got to some very interesting talking points. And to everyone listening, you know, I know that the markets are tough right now, but as someone that has been in Bitcoin for a while, as someone that got his ass handed to him trading options back in 17, 18, I can tell you that, you know, have perspective. If you have a long-term view, you'll be okay. And try to ignore the noise if you can. Try to educate yourself as much as possible. Try to realize that whether it's Trump, whether it's Biden, I don't give a damn who's in the White House. They do not have our interests at heart. You need to have your own interests at heart. With that said, the best way to do that, educate yourself, stay focused, reach out to the community, because there's a lot of smart people in this community, Bitcoin, MicroStrategy, so on and so forth, NVIDIA, Tesla, there's a lot of smart people in these communities. Leverage those resources, and do your best to weather the storm and understand that time is your greatest friend, but it's also your greatest enemy. And if you can understand that nuanced dynamic, you'll be fine.
Yeah, that's great advice. Thank you so much. So everybody, that's a wrap. I do want to thank everybody who joined today. Please follow Adrian. Anybody else that you've seen up on stage asking questions. Great discussion today, and a topic that I think we could probably talk about for hours. One reminder, whether you're a veteran or not, please visit bitcoinveterans.org to fill out that form to get in touch with us, and we'll help get you plugged in on any Bitcoin topic that you're interested in, provide you with helpful resources on your Bitcoin journey. And that's all we have for today. I want to wish you a great Wednesday, and remember not to shitcoin.
Later, guys.
It's like eating toothpaste.